Hello and welcome to A History of the United States, episode 177, Year Zoo. Over the past few episodes, we've been focused on the westward migration, primarily from the perspective of the Euro-American inhabitants of the United States. Two examples were the lives of Daniel Boone, as he pioneered through Kentucky and Missouri, and of William Cooper, who founded the settlement of Cooperstown in upstate New York. The relationship the United States had with the Indian tribes was a recurring theme throughout both episodes, but today we're going to bring Indian relations front and centre, ultimately get into the case of the Yazoo companies. It's been 100 episodes since our deep dive on the Native American tribes, and as you can imagine, a considerable amount has changed since then. The biggest change was the population. War was obviously a factor, but disease had a ruinous effect on the North American continent. Estimates of population size are notoriously difficult, but current theories are that by the year 1700, there were 1.4 million Native Americans living in North America, and of those, around 350,000 were living in the area east of the Mississippi, which is, to all intents and purposes, the America we've been dealing with since the Revolution. Using estimates Secretary of War Henry Knox made to George Washington in 1789, we can deduce that their numbers had dropped by nearly 80% over the course of the century. Knox's figures are probably an underestimate. He calculated there were 5,000 warriors north of the Ohio and 14,000 south of it, with three non-combatants for every warrior, giving a total of 76,000. But regardless of the exact figure, it's clear there had been a drastic reduction, particularly in the north. Most of the tribes in the northeast had vanished. Populations had reduced, and those left intermarried with whites until tribal identity had been lost, while in New York, many had moved north into Canada. The only tribe remaining were the Iroquois, which, once upon a time, had played such a large role in our narrative. But outside of this area, there were still Indians resisting American expansion to protect their way of life. In the eastern and central regions of what is now Ohio, there were Delaware and Wyandot tribes. The Shawnee lived in western Ohio and northern Indiana. Mingos, with villages near Sandusky, also resided in the area. Further north, Ottawa and Chippewa tribes hunted lands south of Lake Erie. Moving westward along the Wabash River, Weyer and Piankashaw bands of Miami could be found. Finally, various Illinois tribes populated Indiana. The southern regions had an even stronger Native American presence. From the Carolinas to the Yazoo River, there were roughly 14,000 warriors. These warriors belonged primarily to the Cherokee, Creek, Choctaw, and Chickasaw tribes. Once again, I apologize for my horrendous pronunciation. I know it's been a while since we've had to deal with it. These tribes were becoming more determined to resist. The colonists had made deals with the Indians to take more and more land, but those remaining felt they could move no further. This would lead to conflict again and again over the following century. The essence of this divide can arguably be traced to different interpretations of what it meant to be free, specifically a free man. To the Euro-Americans, freedom meant the ability to cultivate one's own plot of land for agriculture, while Indian men understood freedom as the ability to roam and hunt as they wished. To them, agriculture was beneath them. We actually have this reported by a missionary to the Oneida, who in 1796 wrote, "To labour in cultivating the earth is degrading to the character of man, who, they say, was made for war and hunting, and holding councils that the squirrels and hedgehogs are meant to scratch the ground." Meanwhile, most of the actual work was done by women. They grew vegetables, collected firewood and water, made clothing and houses. The Euro-Americans were perplexed by this and had great difficulty in understanding the dynamic. They either understood it as that the women were enslaved, or became convinced that because the men did not do it, the Indians did not practice agriculture at all. And from here stems many more misunderstandings. To really understand what's going on, I need to introduce to you Emmerich de Vattel. Emmerich de Vattel was born in Couvet in the Principality of Neuchâtel in 1714. Now, Neuchâtel is a canton in Switzerland, but in 1714 it was part of Prussia. But you do not need to know any of that. What you do need to know is that he was an international lawyer, and in 1758 he published a work called Le Droit des Gens. And that in 1760, this book was translated into English, called The Law of Nations, or Principles of the Law of Nature Applied to the Conduct and Affairs of Nations and Sovereigns. With such a catchy title, it's no surprise that the book was a hit. It was read by Benjamin Franklin, as well as many others at the Continental Congress. It helped define many ideas in American political thought. This was true in the 1700s when Madison would use it to justify his concept of freedom of the seas, as well as in the 1900s when it would be used to justify military conscription in the First World War. And there was one idea in particular that would be used as justification which would have a great impact on our story. That is the belief that a people had no rights to land which they did not farm. Therefore, when Euro-Americans interacted with the Indian tribes, they expected them to either start farming or, to put it simply, get out of the way. One last thing to note before we get into events. The Euro-Americans had a different relationship with the Indians constitutionally than the British had. I know it's been a while since we've had any reason to discuss British constitutionality, but hopefully I've said the phrase parliamentary sovereignty enough times to you that it's forever burned into your brains. Now, British constitutional theory's primary trait is its flexibility. There are a few hard and fast rules, like parliamentary sovereignty. But aside from that, there is a lot of wiggle room to really do just about anything you want. Because of this, the British didn't find relationships with the Native Americans that complicated. As long as a tribe made a token acknowledgement of the supremacy of the British monarch and wasn't going to cause trouble, they were largely free to do what they wanted. Having an Indian tribe within the empire wasn't a problem. Not so with the United States. The American Constitution was the creation of lawyers. Where the British Constitution was flexible, the American Constitution was rigid. Where the British Constitution was vague, the American Constitution was exact. It was, in fact, one specific document that you can read, and we indeed have on this podcast. And the American government was based on free and equal citizens, and three-fifths of all persons. But Indians didn't fit into this. They didn't have equal rights as American citizens, and equally, most of them didn't want to be American citizens. That was a fundamentally different notion to being a British subject. The result was that the American government had no alternative but to view the Indians as foreign nations and make treaties with them. The Confederation government set about this, but like much else the Confederation did, it was largely ignored by the states. So, when the Federalist administration of George Washington came to power, one of his top priorities, along with his Secretary of War, Henry Knox, was to solve the Indian problem. Washington summed up his own position in 1783, that there was nothing to be obtained by Indian war but the soil they live on, and this could be had by purchase at less expense. Knox agreed, declaring, "The Indians, being the prior occupants, possess the right of the soil. It cannot be taken from them unless by their free consent, or by the right of conquest in case of a just war. To dispossess them on any other principle would be a gross violation of the fundamental laws of nature and that of distributive justice, which is the glory of a nation." End quote. What we have here is a response to the uncontrolled westward migration being led by characters like Daniel Boone. Washington and Knox wanted to manage the process and prevent the violence that was bustling up and down the frontier. They saw an alternative as buying the land through treaties, which was a return to the earlier relationship that had existed. However, Knox wanted to go further. Knox saw the declining numbers of Indians and wondered whether they were on the wrong path and whether in the past they should have, quote, imparted our knowledge of cultivation and the arts to the aboriginals of the country, end quote. What Knox is talking about here is the civilizing of the Indians. He believed that if the Indians abandoned their primitive hunter-gatherer ways and took up agriculture and fixed residences, they could progress to a higher level of civilization. If they failed to do this, they would go extinct. Now, to 21st century ears, this has the ring of ethnic cleansing. It was the attempt to end Native American civilization. Historians struggle with how to describe perspectives like this, given modern morals. There are many instances where things go too far. Slavery, sexism, racism, imperialism can all be excused as relevant to the time period, when, in reality, many at the time saw them for the evils they were. This particular Native American policy is more nuanced, in that it represents one of the most liberal and progressive approaches to Native Americans in the 18th century. Many viewed it as a choice between assimilation and destruction, with assimilation as the only humane choice. I'll leave you to dwell on that while we turn back to Washington and Knox, who were on the point of agreeing their first treaty with the Creek, which was ratified by Chief Alexander McGillivray, who arrived in New York to sign it in the summer of 1790. The ceremonies were deliberately grand and lavish, and we're lucky to have a description of the signing by the playwright, poet, and women's rights advocate, Judith Sargent Murray. Murray describes the entrance of the chiefs with shrieks and yells of rise and mirth, of George Washington in rich vestments of purple satin. After a reading of the treaty, Murray describes Washington, quote, rising from his seat, delivered his sentiments in his accustomed, elegant, energetic, and animated manner to the citizens and the kings, chiefs, and warriors assembled. He observed that, as far as he could judge, the treaty was mutually beneficial. He recommended a spirit of amity, and he added that a studied civilization of peace was expected, and he prayed the Great Spirit, the master of their breath, to forbid the infringement of a contract formed under such happy auspices. The address was solemn and appropriate, and it was delivered in sentences which, thus detached, were communicated by a sworn interpreter to the Indians. In their own manner, to each particular, they audibly assented. End quote. Murray then describes Washington signing the treaty and presenting a wampum as a gift along with some tobacco. Washington and McGillivray shook hands, as did a few other Indians, but Murray describes how, quote, the majority seized him by the elbow, entwined their arms with his, and ardently expressed their satisfaction, end quote. The ceremony concluded with a song of peace. The Treaty of New York was exactly what Washington and Knox wanted. The Creek ceded 2/3 of their land and received a federal guarantee of the remaining third. McGillivray also received a trade monopoly and was made a brigadier general in the US Army and given an annual salary of $1,200. Any encroachment on Creek land was forbidden. However, this was not to be a bright new start in Indian-American relations. And that is because a corrupt Georgia legislature undid the Treaty of New York with the greatest real estate scandal in American history, selling off over 15 million acres of Creek land covering most of modern Alabama and Mississippi. The speculators who bought the land called themselves the Yazoo Companies. The impact of this would be continued conflict with the Indians in the South over the next several administrations. And that's where we'll end things for this week. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next time.